Okay, called order this meeting of the House Rules Committee. Welcome, everybody. Full house, that's twice in a row. Not quite as full as it was on last week, but it is Monday, May 16th. We've got a couple of measures for possible introduction. Mr. Sembers, do you want to describe these to us, please?
You have two measures. One is LC 4181. It's a proposed bill on lottery funding for problem gambling. We have a copy of those, plus they've been posted where you can get them on the S drive.
Great, Mr. Chair.
Charleston.
Well, first of all, as a full house, this does not appear to be a casino to me. So, I just okay. Gosh, nobody got it. All right.
They got it. It just wasn't funny.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt LC 4181 as a committee bill dated 5/11/2011.
Charleston moves the introduction of LC 4181 dated 5/11/11 as a committee measure. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Charles,
Mr. Chair, I move LC.
Correction. Let me read it just real quick. It's LC 4192. It's a proposed bill on the implementation of water quality standards.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move LC 4192 as committee bill dated 5/11/2011.
Charleston moves introduction of LC 4192 dated 5/11/11 as a committee measure. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
And then Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you. It is now my time for the sake of those in the room and who may be watching on the Internet, that the introduction of committee bills implies no support or opposition to anything contained in the bills that were just introduced by the members of this committee. It is simply a way of getting them into the process.
Thank you.
So noted for the record. We should just get that audio tape, then we can just press play. And
if she happens to not be here,
I'm pretty good at getting that on the record. Though.
Is Representative Hoyle in the room?
Which she does.
I don't think she is. So I think we're going to try and go in order tonight or today. Representative Hoyle is on her way down. So why don't we just temporarily, the one that I know is going to be really short, right, Mike Dewey, is HCR 25. So let's open a public hearing on HCR 25.
Mr. Chairman, HCR 25 commemorates IBM on the occasion of its centennial.
Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Co-Chair, appreciate the opportunity, members. Mike Dewey representing IBM. With me is Steve Hill. Steve Hill is from Salem, 33 years with IBM, and he is the manager of client services for IBM. And he will, and I stress briefly, explain why it's appropriate to pass this measure on to the full house. So with that, no pun intended, Representative Wilson.
Thank you.
Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chair,
just turn the mic a little toward you and introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, Steve Hill with IBM here in Salem. Thank you for your consideration of this concurrent resolution. You have before you the citations with many attributes of the IBM Corporation and the benefits that many Oregonians receive as a result of their employment and their contribution to Oregon communities. And so I'll just leave that with you briefly and ask if you have any questions.
Representative Burr.
IBM has been a great contributor to the Salem community and where I live and to the state and actually to our global position with regard to technology. However, I may be dating myself, but in my time and in Mr. Stembridge's time, somebody from IBM would not walk into a room wearing other than a white shirt. And I just thought I'd point that out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, thank you for the observation, but we also go by the nickname of Big Blue. So
it's the new IBM, the new softer, cooler, newer IBM. I get that. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else would like to testify on HCR 25? Seeing none, close the public hearing on HCR 25 and open a work session on HCR 25.
Mr. Chair,
Coach Olson.
I move that HCR 25 be adopted, moved to the floor with a due adopt.
Chair Olson moves that HCR 25 be moved to the floor with a due adopt recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, Amy, please call the roll.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Yes.
Representative Garrett.
Excused.
Representative Holby.
Excused.
Representative Winger.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson.
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt.
Aye. Motion carries, and Representative Berger would be willing
would be
to
proud.
Carry
I will wear my best white shirt for the occasion.
Blue.
Oh, blue.
With a blue coat, maybe. That'll be a match.
Before you close the work session,
yes.
I would simply like to note in support of Representative Berger's comment that Thomas Watson would not approve of the answer that she was given in response to the inquiry about white shirts.
I get that.
White shirts.
He liked them. He required everyone to wear a white shirt. Yeah.
Okay, we will close the work session on HCR 25.
We worked that today.
I think we're still waiting on Representative Hoyle, unless I'm not seeing her. So let's move on to number two. Invite Representative Dembrough and Representative Huffman to come forward. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3651.
Mr. Chairman, we have Anna Teske here to staff this measure.
Anna, welcome back.
Thank you. Would you like me to describe
Please.
The bill? House Bill 3651 directs the Joint Boards of Education to prepare a report on the strategies for reducing higher education textbook costs and recommendations for implementing cost-reducing strategy. This bill instructs the board to analyze potential cost savings for K-12 school districts and requires the board to solicit student, faculty, and bookstore manager participation. It directs the board to report to the Interim Committee of the Legislative Assembly prior to October 1st, 2012, and it sunsets on the convening 2013 regular session. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Gentlemen, welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
You're going to tee us up? I'm going to tee us up?
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Who would a team we are.
John Huffman, State Rep for District 59. Glad to be with you. Thanks for hearing this bill. It was actually teed up pretty well by Anna. Textbooks are quite expensive. One of my daughters, Sarah, happens to be attending Chemeketa in the pre-nursing program, getting all the prereqs out of the way. And every term, you know, I come home and she's growling about having to have gone to the bookstore and ordered the new books or bought the new books. One book alone was over $300. Anatomy class, three books, over $500 for the one class. So what 3651 does is recognizes that oftentimes a study by the Advisory Committee on Student Financial Assistance found out that U.S. students are actually paying 10% or more oftentimes in comparison to the price of tuition just for the books. And with those comparisons, I just gave about $500, in excess of $500 for one class. It doesn't take long to gobble that up. So 3651 would direct the Joint Board of Education to explore the efficacy of the provisions of the Federal Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2008 regarding textbook bundling and price disclosure for textbooks and lower textbook prices. Also, they would examine cost-saving strategies such as statewide used book exchanges, statewide bulk purchasing of textbooks, open source materials, instructor-created open source textbooks, share online materials, creating a statewide central repository allowing instructors to locate and use free or low-cost materials, and partnerships with other state, regional, and national organizations. Anything they can uncover to try to help students in Oregon pay less for their books. And with that, I will step down and answer any questions.
Representative Dembrough.
Thank you, Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, and members of the committee. Michael Dembrough, House District 45, Northeast Portland to Park Rose. And Representative Huffman did a great job of teeing this off. I had thought he was just going to talk about the need, which he did very eloquently, I think, but he also went into the solutions, which are this bill, House Bill 3651, which does two things. It directs the joint boards to do two things, to look back and to look forward. To look back at the federal legislation that was passed a couple of years ago, and which you may not know, but it actually had its source in legislation that was passed in this building in 2007, which forbade publishers from bundling supplementary materials with textbooks. It used to be the practice that was done very commonly, and now that is optional. The other thing that it does is it requires pricing to be made transparent to faculty. This bill was passed by this chamber, federal legislation was passed, but the question is it working? Is it making a difference? Is it doing what it was intended to do? And so part of this legislation is to do that kind of look back. The other is to look forward and take advantage of some really cutting-edge, cost-saving technologies and business practices that we believe can substantially bring down the costs of textbooks. You know, Rep. Huffman mentioned the 10% figure of cost of textbooks versus tuition. Well, for community colleges, because tuition is much lower, that ratio is actually much higher. In a lot of cases, people are paying as much for their textbooks as they are for tuition. But this is something that we can control. This is something that we can do something about. And that's what this legislation does. You'll hear from several people. I know we just have a short time for this hearing. But you'll hear from several people who can talk more about the need, but also about some of these new technologies. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions about the bill.
Questions for our two legislative colleagues?
I note that the bill, gentlemen, sunsets at the next. It's just a short-term look. Am I reading it correctly? They make recommendations. They meet at least three times, make recommendation, and then sunset the committee.
Yes, I think the goal is that they're going to give directions to the community colleges and to the universities to implement these recommendations, and hopefully that is what will happen.
So my question is, the fiscal on this particular effort is simply the time and effort of the joint boards. I'm anticipating that we're not looking for unfunded mandates. No. That these institutions are then going to go out and form these, whatever might be suggested as a possible cost saving that may or may not be proven as a cost saving. Do you understand what I'm very concerned about the fiscal that might be embedded in this bill is all I'm putting on sort of on the record.
Yes, thank you. Rep. Berger, Rep. Hunt, Rep. Olson. So we do see it as short term. I will say what I neglected to mention is that there are several other states that have really been upfront in this effort. Florida, Ohio, California have really done innovative work in this area, and we would expect our joint boards to look at those outcomes as well in order to incorporate this.
I'm sorry? Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the University of Oregon, and I suspect at other places as well, textbook acquisition and sale is actually done by a private nonprofit. And I'm wondering if this bill would affect that operation or how you would see that changing in order to do whatever it is that this joint board recommendation might be.
Yes, thank you, Rep. Barnhart and Chairs. The bookstore managers were very much a part of the formulation of this legislation. The University of Oregon bookstore manager in particular, who's a great guy. And they are really committed to bringing down the costs for students and to being a part of these new technologies. And so they welcome this statewide conversation.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We've got four additional folks who have signed up to testify, one via Skype. So if we can call up Eric Frank on the screen, and then we'll invite forward Emily Pleck, Katie Markey, and Dave Rosenfeld to come up to the panel. Emily, Katie, Dave? Yeah, come on up. Oh, I'm sorry. I put the word then in the wrong part of the sentence. So why don't we, Eric, can you hear us okay?
I sure can, thanks.
Why don't we, let's begin, let's begin with Emily and Katie, since we'll go in the order in which they signed up, and then we'll go to the board. Emily and Katie, whichever order you prefer.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, and members of the committee. My name is Katie Markey, and I'm the student body president at Portland State University, and I'm a board member for the Oregon Student Association, representing over 100,000 students from public community colleges and universities across the state. Student leaders representing all 7 public universities and 17 community colleges in Oregon unanimously support the bill and hope that you will vote yes on House Bill 3651. We need to find a way to lower the cost of post-secondary education. This bill is a good start. Textbook costs are an unbounded contributor to the constant rise in the price of education. We talk a lot about tuition and financial aid, but if you can't afford your books, there's no real chance of succeeding in the classroom. With the states around the country continuing to disinvest in higher education, universities are increasing tuition prices and placing the burden of higher education on the backs of students. These hikes in tuition, coupled with increases in the cost of textbooks, are making education an inaccessible dream for many of my peers. At Portland State, students are having to choose between buying food and buying textbooks. So much so that ASPSU, our student government at Portland State, has opened a food bank to help alleviate the burden. However, it isn't enough. By passing this bill, the state will be taking a proactive approach to lessening the burden of education on students. House Bill 3651 has a minimal impact on the boards of education, but the results will have a significant and positive impact on the experience of students in Oregon. By directing the Joint Boards of Education to look into alternative and cost-effective means of providing textbooks to students, we are recognizing the barriers to education textbook prices create. This bill asks that boards of education in the Oregon University system look into ways to reduce textbook costs, and as students, we know that there are many ways to do this. Some student governments use student fees to increase their library's textbook bank. Some student groups help their peers buy and sell their books to each other, but that only works if our professors commit to using older versions of the book. Students have worked with bookstores to keep publishers from bundling books together so that you only have to purchase what you need. Students appreciate when professors assign homework problems in the syllabus from old and new versions of the textbook. And lastly, students across the state have worked with professors to see online textbooks as a real option for their classrooms. Students have tried to tackle this issue, and now we would like the state to commit to lowering the cost of textbooks. Even with all of these cost savings, students are still paying an average of $900 a year for textbooks. On another note, this is the first year universities rolled fees into the cost of tuition so that financial aid would cover both tuition and fees. But the cost of textbooks altogether, or the cost of textbooks, although crucial to the succeeding in the classroom, was not included in this new figure. We need to find a way to better anticipate the cost of success so students can take loans and seek the financial aid they truly need. Please seriously consider the importance of this bill and vote yes on House Bill 3651. Thank you.
Thank you. Emily. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair Hunt and Chair Olson. And as an Oregon faculty member, we always put our students first. So I appreciate Katie's comments. And she eloquently described so many of the problems facing our students. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify before the House Rules Committee in support of House Bill 3651. But I also want to thank you for taking seriously an issue that's contributing to the prohibitive cost of higher education for students across our nation, as well as in our state. My involvement with AFT Oregon has taught me that it's not just an issue facing higher education, our universities and community colleges, but also a crisis that will soon reach our public schools if we're not forward-thinking about the solutions to rising costs of textbooks. I work at Western Oregon University, and I often say to my students and colleagues there that had I to do it all over again, and were I a more serious undergraduate student at that time, I would want to do my education at Western, and I mean that. Unfortunately, what I paid for 1 year of tuition 20 years ago at a large state university is approximately what my students at WOU are paying for 1 year's worth of textbooks. While we've made great strides as a university to try to help make up for declining state support for education, there's little we can do as a lone institution to combat the rising costs of instructional materials. When I last testified on behalf of textbook affordability, I presented examples, page after page of examples, that my students provided of some of these exorbitantly overpriced texts. I pointed out that many of the most expensive books were required for core curriculum classes, what we in the OUS system call LACCs. I described some of the measures being taken at WU to make textbooks affordable for students, but nobody knows more about this than Chris Rupp, our textbook buyer. She's worked at our university bookstore, which is, like the University of Oregon, as Representative Barnhart noted, a private nonprofit bookstore for as long as I've been a faculty member at Western, and she does more than most students to try to find the cheapest books available. I've also submitted some testimony from Chris alongside my own. We both agree that some of the issues that would be examined and identified under the bill's charge might be unwieldy or even unmanageable. Others pose significant possibilities, especially when undertaken at a state level. The agreement that the joint boards might find and the amassed purchasing power of multiple institutions can create opportunities that we as loan institutions cannot find for ourselves. Publishing is still an industry in which money talks, and it's increasingly an industry of innovation, as those testifying in favor of e-books and open source course materials will tell us. As a teacher of many first generation and non-traditional college students, however, I would caution that this is not always the most equitable path forward. However, this bill enables the state to realize its power, identify workable strategies, and engage stakeholders in discussion, as well as in collaborative adaptation and implementation of those solutions that are realizable. I urge you to support House Bill 3651, and I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to take any questions you may have.
Okay. Great. Eric, why don't we go to you next?
Great. Well, thank you for indulging me from this beautiful MOV conference room here at Dulles Airport between flights. My name is Eric Frank. I'm the co-founder and president of Flat World Knowledge, a venture capital-backed college textbook publishing startup. Prior to starting Flat World, I was director of marketing for a division of Pearson Education, the world's largest textbook publishing company. It's no wonder that textbook prices are consistently one of the top few concerns that college students and their parents express in exit surveys. According to the College Board last year, students at public colleges spent an average of $1,122 on textbooks and supplies. Prices are rising at over three times the rate of inflation, and a growing number of introductory-level textbooks now exceed the $200 threshold. The U.S. Department of Education estimates that for a student at a two-year public institution, textbooks and supplies as a percentage of tuition and fees is 72%, 26% for a student at a four-year public institution. Spiking costs also contribute to rising college dropout rates at a time when global competitiveness has never been more paramount. In a public agenda research report for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, 60% of students surveyed said the cost of textbooks and other fees contributed to their decision not to continue with their college education. For educational entrepreneurs, this broken marketplace is ripe for innovation. In 2007, my co-founder, Jeff Shellstad, and I launched Flat World Knowledge, now the leading publisher of commercial open-source college textbooks for higher education. Well-respected leading scholars write those textbooks. They're peer-reviewed, professionally edited, illustrated, designed, but that's where the similarities to the traditional textbook publishing industry end. Our books are published for free online under a Creative Commons open license. Educators have the freedom to use the books as they are, or to reorganize and edit them to suit their unique classroom requirements using our breakthrough online publishing tools and open license. Students can access our books for free online, or purchase alternatives ranging from printed versions in black and white or color, printed on demand, to audio versions, to downloadable PDF versions, to e-reader versions for devices like the iPad and Kindle, with prices ranging at free for an online version at one end to a high of $60 for a color print version on the other. The average student using a Flat World of Knowledge open textbook, when we blend free users and paid users, is spending just $20 per course. Our authors are paid a higher royalty rate than their industry standard, and given the lack of a secondhand market, stand to make more money over a sequence of four semesters than their counterparts who are publishing traditionally, even though there's a free book at the core. The model has gained traction rapidly since we launched our first book in the spring of 2009. We've raised over $30 million in venture capital, with our most recent funding including investments from global media giants Bertelsmann Digital Media Investments and Random House, the world's largest publishing company. We have over 115 authors under contract and 90 titles published or in the pipeline, over 2,000 faculty who've adopted textbooks from over 900 colleges and universities, and 115,000 students using those books today, saving an estimated $9.2 million. We've launched innovative textbook licensing models at public sector institutions and systems like the University System of Ohio, Virginia State University, SUNY New York City, and others, in which textbooks are priced into the fee structure for courses, and which prices for students to access all textbook formats I described are less than $20 per student, and income to the system actually is increased over bookstore incomes today. Finally, and most importantly, we're seeing benefits going beyond just cost savings for students. At Cerritos College, a community college outside Los Angeles, the hypothesis was that if the high cost of textbooks is driving students to drop out, then remove that barrier and pilot students to stay in. In an article published in Community College Weekly, Linda Lacey, Cerritos College president, wrote, quote, "The pilot was a tremendous success. The retention rate was 92%, representing an increase of 10 to 15% across the three courses, and GPAs improved as well. For educators, it doesn't get any better than that. The textbook problem is solvable. I believe we're demonstrating that through a commercial open textbook model. Other models are also emerging, from ebook models to rental models to textbook licensing models. Faculty, institutions, systems, and states have a growing for real options to exercise in solving this problem that didn't exist 5 years ago. Now what remains to solve the problem is to exercise those options. Thank you again for your the opportunity to speak on the matter."
Great, thank you. And bat and cleanup, Dave Rosenfeld.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. For the record, I'm Dave Rosenfeld, Osberg's executive director, Osberg's statewide consumer group, and we support House Bill 3651. To just punctuate a few things that my friend Eric Frank just said, what to expect from this bill. The reason why textbooks are so expensive is mainly that the textbooks market is a broken market. In normal markets, you have a relationship, direct relationship between consumers and the supplier. In the case of the textbooks market, faculty are the ones who actually order the book, even though they're not the ones that pay for the book. That's exactly the way that it ought to be. Faculty should be in control of course material, but because they're a buffer and the ones who are ordering but not paying for the book, then you have a situation that some economists call price inelasticity. So the price of textbooks can just go up and up and up and up, without really any regard to where the consumer is at. That also makes solving the problem quite difficult. You've got the First Amendment rights of the publishers, which you want to make sure you respect. You've got the academic freedom of faculty members, which you absolutely want to respect. So the traditional ways with which you solve these kinds of problems doesn't apply here. This body took some really excellent steps in 2007 that were referenced earlier. We want to thank you for that. Congress subsequently adopted that. Oregon legislature should be very proud of being one of the first states in the country to require publishers to actually have to disclose the price of textbooks to faculty. That's a big way with which you can make the market work a little bit better. There are a lot of other ways you can make the market work better. The nice thing about this bill is that it takes advantage of what's already out there. Some of the entrepreneurs out there, like Eric, that are putting better products onto the market
We have now a system where publishers have to be more transparent to professors themselves, and then obviously there's lots of student concern about it. If you can get the faculty in the room with the students and some administrators and talk through some systemic ways with which we can take advantage of all of these things that are now out there, thanks to your efforts, the efforts of Eric and others, then we might have a shot at really starting to see the price of textbooks, if not come down, at least stabilize over time, and that's good news. So it's a good bill. We encourage support, and thank you very much.
Questions for any of these four panelists? You answered all questions. Great. We appreciate you all three being here, and good luck. I hope you catch your flight. Anyone, those are the folks that have signed up to testify. Did anyone else want to testify on House Bill 3651? Okay. We appreciate bringing this bill forward. Appreciate testimony, and close the public hearing on House Bill 3651 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3649. Invite Representative Hoyle to come forward, and Mr. Stembridge, please bring us up to speed.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3649 requires health benefit insurers that cover prescription eye drops to also cover refills of those prescriptions if the refill is requested within 30 days of the day the original refill was dispensed. The prescription includes a specific number of refills, and the refill requested does not exceed the number of refills prescribed. It declares an emergency. It takes effect October 1st, 2011. You have the -2 amendment, which comes from Representative Hoyle, requires that the refill be requested more than 21 days after the date of the original prescription or last refill.
Thank you. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you, and thank you for seeing me and for agreeing to hear this bill so quickly. This was brought
to my... Can you just introduce yourself for the record?
Sorry, thanks. For the record, I'm Val Hoyle. I represent West Eugene and Junction City. And again, I'm thrilled to be here in front of the Rules Committee today for a very simple bill. This is a simple bill. This is an easy bill. This is a bill that just makes sure that people can get refills for their eye drops if they have glaucoma. And sometimes people run out of their medication early. Sometimes elderly people, they aren't able to get the eye drops in. They might have some kind of palsy or shaking hands, so they run out of their eye drops early. Or if someone loses their eye drops, we want to make sure that they're able to get the medication that protects their sight so they can be good functioning members of society and stay healthy. So this just clarifies that insurance companies can offer those refills before the 30 days are out if it's needed. There were some -1 amendments proposed by John Powell. I'm absolutely fine with those -1 amendments. And we had offered the -2 before I knew that the -1s were being presented. So do you have those?
Staff has not gotten the -1s.
But staff is getting the -1s as we speak.
It's a very simple amendment. And again,
we do have the -2s in front of us.
We're very, you know, very flexible. I just want to make everybody happy.
Do you have the -1s in front of you?
I do not.
Okay.
Do
Amy
not.
Amy has got them.
Oh, now I do. I have the -1s in front of me right now. Thank you.
So, and these come from Mr. Powell.
Mr. Powell.
So maybe
and,
he can describe those in greater detail.
And Representative Olson. And it just really makes sure that that the eye drops are specifically to treat glaucoma. So we're addressing the issue for this one particular disease. Because, again, with glaucoma, it is so very important that people keep the pressure down in their eye and that they keep using their eye drops.
Questions for Representative Hoyle?
Is she the only testifier?
I know. We've got three more folks coming.
Okay. Well, then, Mr. Chair, I am curious how many people are anticipated to be impacted by this, and you may not have that information, but somebody might. So, in the end, somebody can answer that question when they come up here.
Okay.
I'm going to leave that to the certified smart people in the audience.
Didn't want to put you on the spot.
Thank you for that.
Any other questions for Representative Hoyle? Representative Holby, this is your opportunity to put her on the spot.
He does that on a regular basis.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question.
Wow.
Would you consider it a friendly amendment to include pterygiums?
If I knew what they were, I could answer that question better. Thank you very much, Representative Holby, but I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Representative Hoyle.
Thank you.
So let's bring up together Steve Mansberger, Jim Hale, John Powell. The three I've got on my list.
Ron raised his hand. He's got the answer.
Welcome to the Rules Committee. Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, my name is Steve Mansberger. I'm an ophthalmologist from Portland, Oregon. I work for Legacy Health System. I also do research at Oregon Health Science University and at the Veterans Hospital as well. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology to express our support for House Bill 3649. We are happy to join our optometric colleagues in support of this legislation. The purpose of this bill is to help our patients with glaucoma by allowing them to refill their prescriptions for eye drops early with insurance coverage. You asked about the number of patients this may be affected. About 2 to 8% of patients, depending on the ethnicity, have glaucoma over the age of 40. And what happens with patients with glaucoma, especially elderly patients, is when they put in their eye drops, they miss the eye, it hits their nose, hits their forehead, and runs down their face. Sometimes they squeeze the bottle a little too tightly, and they'll waste drops in the bottle. I actually had a patient who just called me on Saturday who was doing a flight, and his bottle was left open in his cargo, and it dripped out. And glaucoma medications can cost anywhere from $20 to $120 per month. And so what happens is when they run out of the medicine early, sometimes the insurance company will say, well, you can't get it until your 30 days is up. So they go several days without any eye drops, and their pressure goes high, and they lose their peripheral vision. That's what happens to glaucoma, is you lose your peripheral vision. So glaucoma is the second leading cause of blindness worldwide. It's very common, and anyway, we hope that this will help with patients. Dr. Hale will now discuss how this bill will prevent blindness, and I want to thank the committee for allowing us to support this and testify in support of this bill.
Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Dr. Jim Hale. I'm the president-elect of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association, and I'm a practicing optometrist in Corvallis. And I'm here in support of this bill. And before I get started, I just want to pass on a huge thank you, to Representative Val Hoyle, who used one of her priority bills for this bill. And we're very grateful for her insight into this problem. And thank you again, Representative Hoyle. Dr. Mansberger covered what the problem is. Glaucoma patients tend to be elderly on average. They tend to have trouble getting their eye drops in. They tend to run out early. So this bill, simply put, instructs the insurance companies to allow those patients that run out early or lose their eye drops to have a refill ahead of schedule. It's that simple. It's a problem in our community. Citizens of Oregon, your constituents, face this problem. We tend to get periodically kind of frantic phone calls from patients worried that they're going to go blind if they have to stay off of their eye drop for a week. They can't afford to buy their own. So this measure fixes it. So we're here to testify again in support of HB 3649. And I'm happy to answer any questions if you have any. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. We're here to support the bill with the Dash 1 amendments. And the Dash 1 amendments are similar to the Dash 2 amendments in one respect, and that is it puts some limitation on the number of days between getting I wouldn't call it a free refill because there would likely be a copay involved, but a refill under this act. The other portion of our amendment is specifies for glaucoma. So those are the two things it does, and it simply means that if you go and get an early refill, then it has to have been 30 days since your last refill, if that makes sense. That so you can't do it every single month, but you could do it every other month under this. So we think that resolves the issue at hand, and we do recognize that this happens. And in our plan, if we are contacted, we already allow for this to occur, and it does happen, as the doctors have pointed out.
Questions for these witnesses? Representative Burr.
Clearly, this is not a drug that is likely for abuse. In other words, there's no value to having a whole bunch of this stuff on the shelf. I just want that on the record, please, gentlemen. That and head nods aren't on the record.
I agree.
Thank you.
I agree that abuse is unlikely.
I just wanted that on the record.
Any further questions? So, Representative Barnhart.
Just really quickly, what are the drugs that are typically used for this purpose cost?
I did not mention that. You know, there are some generic medications that may be as low as $20 to $10, and patients may have copay on top of that. Then there's some branded medicines that may cost between $100 and $140 per month. Usually the cost is $10 to $140. Most patients will be on an average of two drops, so it's about, you know, at least over $100 usually per patient.
Representative Barnhart is still angling for that prescriptive authority for psychologists, so that's why I'm asking.
We want to be able to prescribe anti-glaucoma medication.
You may not if you don't want them to be able to read your bill.
Can I just clarify, in terms of, I think I heard Mr. Powell clearly say he was supportive of both the dash ones and the dash twos. Certainly the dash twos, at least the dash ones.
Mr. Co-Chair,
if you can all clarify where you are on the two amendments.
With the dash ones, the dash twos are not necessary.
Okay. And can the two of you address where you are in the amendments?
Yeah, Steve Mansberger, I actually support these dash two amendments, because if patients are asking for more medicines every month, we need to get them into our clinic and teach them how to put the drops in. So I approve these amendments.
Thank you, Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, members of the committee. The Oregon Optometric Physicians Association is also supportive of the Dash 1 amendments. Were they necessary, we would have been supportive of the Dash 2s as well. They are not at this time necessary. And also, I'd like to point out that it's really a pleasure to be working with the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology. Ooh. And with the insurance companies as well. Thank you.
It's especially a pleasure for us, because most of us don't like when you all are on opposite sides of scope of practice issues. It's never any fun for those of us on this side of the dais. So. Representative Holby.
Mr. Chair, I was just curious. No one addressed my issue with pterygiums, and was curious if, because pterygiums need eye drops too, I believe, or at least I think they do, and I wonder why you would discriminate against people with pterygiums.
I can discuss that. Pterygiums are usually what happens, they're a mound right here by your nose on the white part of the eye, and they become dry. With sun exposure and wind exposure. So the treatment is artificial tears, which are not prescription medicine. So we're not discriminating against the pterygium people.
And in the rare circumstance, Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, members of the committee, in the rare circumstance that the pterygium were to become very inflamed and red, there could be medications prescribed, but it's fairly uncommon, and it's not likely to be a chronic scenario like with glaucoma where they need it every single day for a long period of time.
Hmm. And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Representative Holby.
So who would treat those?
Mr. Chair,
we all would.
Medical advice.
Representative Holby, do you have a priority bill you want to queue up? Then we can have a hearing on that.
Never mind.
Thank you, gentlemen, all very much. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Would anyone else like to testify on House Bill 3649?
Serious question.
Seeing none, we appreciate you bringing that forward and close the public hearing for now on House Bill 3649. And Amy, maybe we can let, I don't see either of the sponsors of 3653 here. Maybe you can call them, and for now let's skip down one to opening a public hearing on House Bill 3657. Mike Kurt Ford, and ask Mr. Sandbridge to describe the bill.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3657 reduces Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission non-resident commercial fishing fees to no more than $50 more than resident fees. You have the Dash 1 amendment, which allows the commission to charge the correct fee for the fishing year that the license is good for, regardless of when the license is renewed.
Kurt, welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you.
Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I appreciate the opportunity to come here today with House Bill 3657. I'm providing some brief written comments as well, and Mr. Stembridge did a good job of summarizing at least the background on the bill. So House Bill 3657 would reduce non-resident commercial fishing fees to a level essentially $50 more than all resident, like resident commercial fishing fees. I think Mr. Stembridge mentioned the Dash 1 amendment, which is simply clarifying when this reduction would be effective, which is effective with our calendar year 2012 licenses and permits. So regardless of the time of issue, the new fee would be in effect for those 2012 licenses. I wanted to provide a little bit of background on why we're recommending or bringing this bill forward to you. A group of non-resident commercial fishermen from the state of Washington have challenged our disparity in non-resident commercial fishing fees on constitutional grounds. As a result of that challenge and the pending litigation, we have the department has taken a close look at our non-resident fee structure relative to the costs associated with administering non-resident commercial fishing licenses, and we believe and are recommending that this reduction in fees would essentially more closely align our fees charged with the cost of administering those programs. And lastly, we believe that passage of this legislation would resolve our pending litigation. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Appreciate the time here today.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Kurt? All questions answered. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And would anyone else like to testify on House Bill 3657? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3657 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3653. Invite Representative Widener forward. Mr. Stembridge.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 3653 expands the allowable dog training on land zoned for exclusive farm use, and it declares an emergency, takes effect upon passage. You have the Dash 2 amendment that clarifies the activity does not qualify the land for farm tax deferral.
Great. We've got a whole page full of folks on this, so we'll ask folks to go through quickly. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having me here today, and I have not had a chance to look at the Dash 2 amendments. I knew about the Dash 1s. So, I'm State Representative Jim Widener, House District 24, most of Yamhill County and a little bit of Polk County. I'm here today on House Bill 3653. House Bill 3653 came into existence after several counties encountered some misunderstandings regarding dog training on land exclusivity zone for farm use. Some interpreted the statute to exclude dog training and attempted to extract fees to operate their dog training practices on such land. In all actuality, under ORS 215203, dog training is allowed to operate as it relates to animal husbandry, just like equine training. It states farm use means the current employment of land for primary purpose of obtaining a profit in money by raising, harvesting, and selling crops or feeding, breeding, management, and sale of, or the produce of livestock, poultry, fur-bearing animals, or honeybees, or for dairying and the sale of dairy products or any other agriculture or horticultural use, animal husbandry, or any combination thereof. So a lot of things covered in that. It's my interpretation, along with the AKC, that the fur-bearing animals would relate to such activity like dog training. These small businesses that operate dog training require room away from highly urban areas and often supplement other agricultural activities on the same premise. Dog training has less of an environmental impact that farming, allowing acreage to become restored while it is in use for other training of dogs. My intent in this bill is to further clarify that dog training is in line with other training, such as equine training, and similar to animal husbandry. This clarification will remove the burden placed upon those who operate dog training facilities and allow them to flourish during these dire economic times. I enjoyed working with the AKC and the National Animal Interest Alliance, and my dear colleague, Rep. Mike Schaffler. It has been my pleasure to help this common sense bipartisan solution that removes undue regulation on dog trainers, allowing them to them clarified freedom to continue their business. And I want to thank all of you for your support and consideration of House Bill 3653 today.
We've got lots of witnesses behind Representative Widener. Any questions for Representative Widener? Representative Holby.
Thank you. I appreciate bringing this bill forward. I was looking at it and support the idea behind it. I was kind of curious, though, why, if there was a reason to amend 215-203 in defining this as a farm use, instead of defining this as an allowed activity on farmland under 215-213 and 283, which seem to be, when I'm looking at it, it looks to be a better section to that also already includes kennels in it. I'm just sort of curious if that was a consideration.
It's what we worked with the AKC and also with LC on, but you'll run into lots of situations. I know people who train dogs for herding sheep and use them for different activities, and that's why we put them under farm use, because just like a horse, when you're training horses or a horse training facility, all of that is covered under the same section, so we wanted to keep everything tied together, and that's why it ended up there. So that's where LC, I think, found it fit, and I think we have people behind me who probably will be able to give you a little more detailed information on that.
Thanks. Okay. Thank you very much for coming to the Rules Committee.
Thank you.
Let's bring up Patty Strand, Pat Wildman, and Amber Hatchell. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you. Co-chairs Hunt and Olson, members of the committee. My name is Patty Strand. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I thank you very much for hearing this bill on such short notice. This was, as you know, a bill that had a different number just a short time ago, and so we really appreciate being able to come here today. I am here today representing members of the Oregon Dog Community and the National Animal Interest Alliance, which is a national organization that's headquartered in Oregon, specifically in Portland, that represents a broad range of professional and lifestyle interests involving dogs. We represent professors who work in animal science. We work with farmers and ranchers and dog and cat enthusiasts and veterinarians and a host, basically just everybody who works with animals. I have personally been involved in the Oregon dog community since 1969. I've belonged to Oregon several Oregon kennel clubs and have served on the AKC Board of Directors for the last 16 years. I'm here today to urge your support of 3653, and we do support the -2 amendments. They were actually left out of this iteration of the bill by accident. We wanted that included. We are not looking for a tax deferral. The bill is needed to clarify that income-producing dog activities are legitimate farm uses under the EFU, the Exclusive Farm Use Statute. The problem, and the reason we're here, is that although the current language of the statute clearly accommodates such dog activities, and many counties are, some counties are not interpreting it in that way. Instead, activities such as dog training, which are in very high demand, which preserve farmland and benefit Oregon's economy, have been closed solely because they are situated on EFU lands. Without legislative clarification, these traditional and valuable activities and their economic impact on Oregon will be lost. That's what we fear, and for no good reason. We do not believe that the source of this problem is a policy or a legislative decision that's happened anywhere, but rather the result of unintended consequences because of the complex and evolving nature of Oregon land use laws, which make county administrators feel constrained to approve activities which are not specifically allowed in the law. And although we are included under the husbandry language that was read to you by Representative Widener, and there actually is a Supreme Court decision that says that we fit under that, counties are still, some counties, a few, are still having trouble with that. A complicating factor is that activities for greyhound racing dogs are specifically allowed in the statute. This happened in the mid-90s, 1996, I believe, leading administrators to look for language to justify other dog activities. In fact, we've seen land use board appeals that are really based on this. They say, well, gosh, greyhounds are allowed, but dogs aren't. So the fact that we're mentioned under husbandry gets lost, and we have trouble there. So why is this important? Well, for one thing, the economic impact of dogs on Oregon's economy is huge. According to statistics that are provided by the American Pet Product Manufacturers Association, nearly 40% of all Oregon households have a dog. That translates to 550,000 households in Oregon alone that have a dog. These people, they buy dog food, they buy pet products, they purchase a wide variety of services such as veterinary care, boarding kennel, services, and they seek training. And in recent years, they have begun participating in dog sports and activities in record numbers. Dog sports took off in the United States at the beginning, actually, of the 20th century, about a century ago. And AKC and 4-H were the leading entities at that time. So they were pioneers in this, but it's continued to grow throughout the last century. Not only do these events offer fun, wholesome activities for families and lots of extra economic impact, but they also, and I think this is very important, this is very important to me anyway, I think that they provide a bridge between rural and urban lifestyles by helping to maintain an understanding of animals and husbandry among an increasingly urban population. And I think that ongoing loss is a very serious problem. Now, AKC alone, and there are many other registries and there are many other hosting organizations for dogs in the state of Oregon, but AKC alone has 103 kennel clubs. And in last year in 2010, we put on over 562 events, and we brought in, these events brought in $18.5 million into the state of Oregon. So people love these activities, and they participate in record numbers. Another reason that this clarification is needed is that dog training and other dog activities are compatible with the land, having less impact than other many other species. Dogs actually help preserve farmland by providing income to farmers during off seasons and difficult times. Further, and this is unacceptable, Oregon citizens have lost their livelihoods due to, I would say, incorrect and inconsistent interpretations that consider dog training and other activities to be illegitimate uses on EFU lands. I think few seriously question whether dogs and dog activities belong on farms. Dogs are the species that enabled our ancestors to settle into an agrarian lifestyle in the first place. There's testimony to this on cave walls all over France and Spain. This association has been going on for a long time. And in more modern times, I think the lyrics in Old MacDonald's Farm have to have some relevance here, because there's always a woof woof here or a bow wow there. And then just beyond that, dogs and their myriad talents are appreciated by more Americans every year than ever before. This is a growing interest. So in closing, I ask for your support for HB 3653, so that no matter how urbanized Oregon becomes, dogs will always retain their special place in our lives and on Oregon farms. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Whichever of you would like to proceed, welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thanks for having me, chairs and committee. I'm Pat Wildman. I'm treasurer of Linn County Kennel Club. You have received by email a letter addressed Buyer Club. In addition, I would like to point out that I see this bill as a terrific opportunity to bring youth in to train a dog. If I knew today, with all my dog training experience that I have, if I knew that when I was raising my children, I think I would have done a better job. I'd like to see kids have that opportunity with supervision from adults that are already doing this type of thing, and going forward, learning how to train a dog. And then the other thing I would like to say that I really would appreciate you to pass this bill is I am a farmer with a farm going into Dallas, Oregon. It's a very small farm. We are trying just doing everything we can to make it profitable, although I do not have any intent to put dog activities on my farm at this time. It would give me the opportunity, and we're looking for revenue opportunities. And I thank you very much for hearing me, and I hope you will support this bill and pass it to the floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak today, members of the committee. My name is Amber Hatchell. I was an agility instructor here in Oregon, and unfortunately, due to the interpretation of some of the county laws, or the reading of the laws, I actually had to take my business to Washington State. I'm sad about that because I have also had Oregon State people come with me to Oregon, to Washington, so they also have taken their economic support away from Oregon in this instance. I myself spend $100 to $400 a month on just supporting local businesses for my practice and experience with dog agility, and unfortunately I've also had my students come with me, and I would love the opportunity to come back to Oregon and to bring that economic support in this time of economic hardship to Oregon. So I ask that you please support and pass H. Bill 3653. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions for these first three witnesses? Seeing none, thank you all very much. We appreciate you being here. Bring up our next three, Douglas Schmidt, Michael Morrissey, Arch Lack. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you. Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Douglas Schmidt. I'm the Polk County Assessor. And I was here today to ask for clarification, but I may already have gotten it with the Dash 2 amendment. Basically, it takes this out of the farm use qualifying provision. It looks like it eliminates anything out of the 308A, which is the farm use qualification statutes. And that was my concern because even though it was expressed that this would not grant farm deferral to dog training facilities, it was still in the bill. But if the Dash 2 amendment is included, then it basically takes that. It leaves it as a zoning issue at that point under, I think, 215. And takes it out of the qualifying for farm deferral issue. So if that's the case, then I'm not going to give the testimony that I was originally going to give.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you. Welcome.
Co-chairs Hunt and Olson and committee members, I'm Michael Morrissey. I'm a policy analyst with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I'll have an answer for Rep. Holvey's question in my testimony. This bill, as I think you probably know, had a previous incarnation as House Bill 3047, and we testified at that time, and we do support the general objectives of this bill, but we did suggest some different ways to get there, if you will. We also agreed that removing the farm tax deferral would be a good idea. Our other main concern with this bill had to do with establishing a right as a outright farm use for these dog agility training facilities, which we thought was not entirely consistent with an outright farm use. We also noted that at this time there are almost 50 non-farm uses allowed on farm zones, and there was an attempt to clarify or rationalize those farm uses. And so our recommendation, which was actually written up as amendments to 3047, and so they've already been through legislative council and were introduced and discussed but not passed before the demise of the bill, instead took this right out of outright farm use and instead expanded the current right to operate a kennel as a conditional use. And so I'm prepared to offer those amendments if anyone wants to take me up on that and go that route instead. So this would be a conditional use process to allow dog agility training along with kenneling and other dog activities. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Art, welcome.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And would like to share with you, a concern, partly which is being addressed at this point. From a land use standpoint, would just note that there are a number of uses that are allowed in a farm zone that are not under what's called sub 1 uses allowed by reason, but are allowed as conditional uses, and kennels are one of those kinds of uses. And I would just submit to you that this is very close in proximity to the same kinds of activities that go on at dog kennels, which are allowed in a farm zone as a conditional use permit, and would just suggest that you maybe take a look at that as something that may be appropriate. Secondly, at this point, the dash 2 amendments deal with the other issue that we wanted to bring to your attention, that that had to do with the farm assessment at this point, and the fact that if the dash 2s are adopted as brought forward at this point, that these dog agility facilities at this point would not be subject to farm assessment as they would if they were defined as farm use under the initial bill at this point. So we would, if the committee finds that this bill is worthy and should go forward in its current form, the dash 2 amendments would be highly recommended. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Hunt. Real quick, could you describe the difference in process between getting a conditional use permit, fees associated with any sort of procedure that has to happen through local land use stuff versus it just being an outright use?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Freeman, a conditional use permit is subject to a public hearing, usually before a hearings officer, but not always at this point. So it is subject to a public hearing with notice and the ability of people to comment and express any concerns at this point. And the decision of the permitting authority could be appealed. So and that's contrasted, needless to say, to a use by right, which can take place without any review. And so the questions about infrastructure and compatibility issues, hours of operation and those kinds of things, lighting, different kinds of things that might impact the community are not subject to a review.
Representative Freeman?
Generally, there's a fee associated with a conditional use permit.
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Freeman, yes, there is a fee. It will vary from county to county, from a couple hundred dollars, maybe on up at this point.
Further questions for this panel? Representative Holby.
Thanks. I appreciate your comments. I actually hadn't reviewed the previous bill and your discussion of that, because when I was looking at this bill, I was looking at this as an activity that should be allowed on agricultural lands as a use, and not really just being declared a farm use. So I actually support the amendment that you refer to, think very strongly that these activities should be allowed on farm agricultural lands, and so I don't know if you really described what, you know, the difference between an activity and a farm use are, and why does this bill to you seem more appropriate to be an allowed use on farm zones instead of being declared a farm use?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Hovey, I was, in my testimony, I was bringing an analogy between a kennel and this kinds of activities because, you know, you're going to have a large number of dogs potentially there. There's going to be a day-long activity. There could be lots of parking of vehicles. There could be light. There could be amplified sound equipment. There could be a number of things that might have a impact on the community, the surrounding area. There may be an impact on adjacent farming operations depending on what's going on and what's there. So the conditional use permit, while it, you know, provides the opportunity to have that activity take place, and it's clarified in statute that it's an allowable conditional use permit, there is a public review and there is the opportunity for adjacent property owners to have some input in terms of the potential impact. At this point, I might just indicate there's a bill in the Senate Bill 960 that deals with events and activities on farmland that stems from these very kinds of activities that are taking place out in the agricultural community, and it's our hope that that bill will help provide some opportunities also at this point. But the concept here, I believe, is good. It's a question of the way you get there.
Please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hunt and Co-Chair Olson and Rep. Hovey. I think that the expanding the standard for what is an outright farm use is ought to meet a higher threshold than perhaps this activity, for one. And two, there was a bill actually that eliminated kenneling of greyhounds specifically as a conditional use, but it was left, I'll say, vestigially as an outright use, and that's where the proponents of this bill chose to go. We think probably that should have been removed as an outright use as well as some of the conditional use statutes. So we think they should have come up from both places, and instead they went in and modified this as an outright use where it seemed to remain. So, again, I think that's a higher standard to expand what is an outright farm use. I think that's a higher level, and I think that expanding the greyhound kenneling and these related activities would be a more appropriate place. And if I may, Mr. Chair, the language would be very simple. Where it currently says dog kennels, the amendments that we propose would say facilities for breeding, raising, kenneling, or training of dogs for racing or other canine skills, including but not limited to agility, obedience, tracking, lure coursing, and herding. And we use those specific words because of some of the testimony that we'd heard and what was in the bill as originally drafted.
Okay. Just one quick follow-up.
Hold it.
So in that description, though, I didn't hear anything about events. So if they were having an agility event on in that, I would think that you would probably want to make sure that was covered.
Oh, yes, sir. the reason I paused is the whole issue of what's an event and how many events and the scope is in some of the discussion that's been going around that Mr. Slack related to, and I don't think we're meaning to eliminate that option with our language.
Thank you.
Last word, Representative Freeman.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate this discussion, but I don't want it to go unnoticed that this is yet again one more situation where we have private property owners trying to use their property in a way that they can continue to own their property, and we have a group of people from the government here telling us that isn't the right thing to do. I just thought that's worth noting.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to, we need to get Representative Kotek, she's got to get her in and out. So we're going to recess the hearing. We'll close the hearing and reopen.
Recess the hearing.
So we're going to
for now recess this hearing on, and we will come back to it today, so don't leave. Folks are here to testify on this, on House Bill 3653, and open the public hearing on House Bill 3086. Mr. Stenberg.
Mr. Chairman, you have House Bill 3086, and the discussion is on the Dash 1 Amendment, which replaces the measure. It abolishes the State Commission on Children and Families, establishes a 9-member Early Learning Council in the Governor's Office to coordinate early childhood services with public education system, replacing the Commission. Members of the Council are appointed to 4-year terms subject to Senate confirmation and serve at the pleasure of the Governor. It directs the Council to submit a report, including recommendations for legislation, if any, to legislative committees by November 1st, 2011, establishes a 12-member task force on improving educational success for at-risk youth, including 4 legislators, 8 other members with expertise in at-risk youth and educational resources appointed by the governor. It directs the task force to review current funding sources, make recommendations regarding the coordination of programs and services for at-risk youth, and report to legislative committee by November 1st, 2011. It directs the council to provide staffing to the task force. It abolishes the local commissions on children and families effective June 30th, 2012, declares an emergency, takes effect upon passage, with provisions becoming operative on June 30th, 2011. We also were given today dated today the Dash 2 amendments that address the local commissions on children and families issue. I don't have any more description of that. These are 125-page, 150-page amendments.
So even the Dash 2 is a long one as well?
Yes, and they've been posted to the S-Drive for you, and we are, I'm not sure if we've gotten them on the Internet. Yeah, we have the Dash 1 on the Internet, but I'm not sure that we have the Dash 2 on the committee's website just yet.
So just to clarify, in case you're looking at our agenda, this is a complete gut and stuff. So this bill that we're discussing, the Dash 1 or the Dash 2 amendments, have nothing to do with preparation of minority racial and ethnic impact statements. So we're on to a complete gut and stuff. Representative Kochak.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you for hearing this bill today. Good co-chair is correct. House Bill 3086 was a placeholder, has a relating to children clause. Please disregard the original content of the bill. The Dash 1 Amendment, hopefully, my goal and the goal of folks who have been working on this is to amend the bill with the Dash 1 and move it to Ways and Means for further work. I know you have a lot of work in this committee. Members of the Ways and Means Committee have been struggling with how to properly respond to the governor's initiative to set up an early learning council to refocus our efforts here in the state on the 0-5 age range. There's been a lot of support for that, but it's been very unclear how you actually go about doing that. So hence you have a very long bill, most of which are conforming amendments. And what I've handed out today is a very brief summary of what the Dash 1s do. In fact, the Dash 1 fiscal that you have does a nice job as well. But essentially, what the Dash 1 amendments would do is establish the Early Learning Council on the 1st of July of this year, and that's in Sections 1 through 4. It would eliminate the State Commission on Children and Families and transfer all of their funds and programming to the Early Learning Council, and that's where you have most of the conforming amendments, because to make it easier for legislative council, we just had them replace State Commission on Children and Families in the statute with Early Learning Council, except for the portion that were the actual commission members themselves that would be eliminated. It also directs the repurposing of the local commissions on children and families to align with the Early Learning Council. So you see some language in Section 59 to say to the local commissions that are the 36 local commissions around the state to look at what you're doing and come up with a recommendation to align with the what will eventually be the design of the Early Learning Council and the statewide system coming out of a team appointed by the governor. And in addition to that, it also sunsets the existing local commission on children and family statutes on July 1 of 2012, assuming that there would be statutory changes in 2012 to replace. Now, you will hear some concerns from representatives of the local commissions on children and families that's concerning. I totally understand that. I think the Dash 2s were an attempt to address that. My understanding is they're not correct in spots. I'm very open to working with my co-chairs in the subcommittee to look at additional amendments. Perhaps I think one of the easiest ways would to take off the sunset, because I think that's a concern. the reason that was there is for ease of how do you send a message to the local commission system that things will change. I think there's a lot of interest in being part of the Early Learning Council design restructure, and it was an inartful way of doing that. So I think removing the sunset in the Ways and Means Committee would probably allay a lot of their concerns. And lastly, it creates a task force on improving educational success for at-risk youth. That's Section 5, because what we realize as we move funds over the Early Learning Council, there's a whole set of funds and programs that are really for school-age and adolescent youth. And so you have investment dollars, juvenile crime prevention dollars, which there is an opportunity here, as in the Early Learning Council, to align those fundings and programs in a way that really connect better with the educational success and the goals of the K-12 system. So this would set up a task force, say, go look at these funds and programs and come back to us. Again, it was an attempt to make some sense out of a lot of competing ideas out there. Senate Bill 909, which is currently in Ways and Means, is also has Early Learning Council language because it's part of the Oregon Education Investment Board. It's the governor's bill. So our understanding is if both of those bills move, we try to align the Early Learning Council language. So what I would ask is that you adopt the Dash 1 today and move it to Ways and Means without recommendation if that's your choice. I think you'll hear testimony today that says we still have work to do, and I'm very open to that. And with that, I'll conclude. Thanks so much.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Hunt, and thank you, Representative Kotek, for that brief description of what is a monumental bill. and I agree with what you said. There is a desire to start the process of creating an early childhood council and use this as the first step. The word abolish the councils is very troubling out in the community, and I would prefer us to find a way to talk about how we're going to take the next step or evolve what we've currently built. I think that the Commission on Children and Families, especially in our local communities, provides a very valuable service, and the idea of helping them to evolve into better coordinating all the different services throughout our committees is the right goal of this legislation, and I will also commit as one of the co-chairs of the subcommittee to making sure that is explicit in the bill in the final product. So thank you for bringing that forward.
Thank you.
Further questions for Representative Kotek? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're off your meeting on time.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnett, I thought, was in the room. Did he step out? Okay. Let's go back and finish up 3653, and then Representative Wisnett will arrive and we'll jump in, because we have several people to testify on 3086. But not enough. We should still be out before 5. So let's temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 3086 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3653. Invite forward Debbie Berkeley, Jan Curry, Elaine Reznor, I believe. You were all very well coordinated with your buttons today. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you.
Whichever order you'd like to go in.
You start.
Am I designated?
Yeah.
Chairs Hunt and Olson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Deborah Berkeley. I live in Beaver Creek, Oregon, Clackamas County. I'm here today representing the sport of dog agility. I am one of numerous instructors in this state. I'm also here representing an EFU land use interpretation that has forced the closure of my business and jeopardizes my being able to stay in my home. I'd like to share my personal story. My husband and I are native Oregonians, and we moved from southeast Portland in 1994 to a small 10-acre farm in Beaver Creek, zoned EFU. And the reason we moved is our family was actively involved in training and showing horses. It was a perfect place, and we set up a small farm business centered around those activities. Our kids grew up. They lost interest in horses. We didn't want to pay the expense of maintaining them, and we sold them, and we were looking for an alternative use for our farm. and that's when I discovered dog agility. It was a relatively new sport. The competitions in this area are held on grass surfaces or in covered horse arenas, both of which were on my farm. I got very involved in agility. People started coming to me for assistance, and before long I had classes going, a business. And so I went to Clackamas County to inquire about permits and licensing, and the clerk who assisted me told me that he couldn't find dog agility anywhere in the ordinances. But he also said, because he couldn't find it there, it wasn't specifically prohibited, and his suggestion was that I just go ahead and set up a business. So I did. I set up the business. I've been teaching for 12 years. I've been paying the appropriate taxes. I've had students from all over Oregon and Washington. In October of 2009, I got a letter from Clackamas County informing me that agility was not a permitted use on exclusive farm use land. It was generated from an anonymous complaint to Clackamas County, and this complaint was not a nuisance complaint. It was not a code violation. It was simply that I was doing dog agility on EFU land. With my business closed, I couldn't afford to stay there. We put our house on the market in an attempt to relocate the business. And ironically, as I was looking for places to relocate, I was looking for farms with pasture and covered horse arenas. A year later, our house is still unsold. I've not been able to relocate my business. In the meantime, during this time, I've been working with Clackamas County, both the commission and the planning and zoning departments, and the commission is very much in support of this, I wanted to say. We've explored a lot of options. There's really no solution at the county level. The closest we came was examining the home occupation permit. In its current form, it would require that I place a wall down the middle of my horse arena to restrict the floor space 30 to 50 feet, 1,500 square feet. One piece of our equipment is 36 feet long. I mean, it's impossible to do this sport on that. It also would prevent me from using my pasture. I can't do anything outdoors. It restricts the hours of operation between 9 and 5. I deal with working people. They need evening classes. I deal with students. They're in school during the day, and they frequently come out in the evening. I, like many others, just want to use my farm. I don't want to change it. When I did horses, I could. The county had no problem with me doing virtually anything I wanted to do. Dogs have far less impact on the land. One of the main purposes of EFU zoning is to preserve agricultural land. My business does exactly that. Dog owners are really in desperate need of finding properties like mine to do training. It can't be accomplished in urban areas, and it's not just agility. I've been asked and have rented my land for things such as 4-H, field work, tracking, search and rescue, draft training. Again, I urge your support of this bill recognizing dog training activities as legitimate farm use. Passage of this bill will result in me being able to stay in my home and keep my business here in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you. Co-chairs Hunt and Olson and members of the committee. My name is Jan Curry. I'm from Silverton, Oregon. I have prepared some testimony. I'm not going to address it. Basically, other people have talked about it. I would like to address what the gentleman from Land Use and Conservation Development, somewhere in there.
Got it.
Used to be LCDC. What I want to address is I'm a little concerned by what he said. The information, the dog kenneling in the language that you referred to in the activity portion of the bill, that was put in last session by Representative Klim. They took out dog kenneling there, hoping that this was going to be something, because this issue has been before the legislature before. Okay, so that was taken out so that we could operate dog kenneling facilities. If you look at LC ADDs, administrative rules, regarding dog kenneling, after that bill was passed, they have said that dog kenneling cannot be done on high-value EFU land. You're sure you're well aware of most of the land in Oregon is high-valued farm use land, as is Debbie's. And so under that dog kenneling language that he was offering to you, her property still, with their current administrative rule, could still not be engaged in. So I think it's really important to note, yes, you could change those portions of the statute, but every time we turn around and try to find a way to get dog kenneling, the dog training into properties, there's always something that some rule that comes up or the expense that comes up, because a horse arena more than likely is not going to meet the commercial zoning requirements or building requirements that they have when you try to have a home occupation or use other parts of the statute. So some of the county regulations continue to prevent people from using existing horse arenas that are no longer used for horse arenas because people are moving away from horses. They can't use existing arenas to have dog kenneling. So I think that's important as you start looking or trying to look at other amendments. I think the restrictions that continue to be placed on it make it very difficult to do it. So that's why, as we reintroduce the bill this time, you find it in the section of the statutes that's in the 215-203. And with that, I do urge your support of this bill, and thank you very much for allowing me to testify. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, great. Thanks. You could slide your mic over to Elaine. Welcome.
Yes, Co-Chair Olson and Co-Chair Hunt, my name is Elaine Resner, and I live in Beaverton, Oregon. And I'm kind of a bottom-line person, so I'm just going to say it the way it is. First of all, one of the things that we're not asking for is we're not asking for any money. It costs nothing to implement this bill whatsoever. It's kind of ironic because horses used to play a very big part in the life of farms, and they don't anymore. Horses don't pull plows. We have tractors now. And if you want to go survey your land, you jump on your ATV. So horses aren't playing that kind of a role anymore, and most of them are recreational activities. However, dogs still work on farms, and I would venture to say they're probably one of the few animals left that really are working on farms. So they herd sheep, they protect the sheep, they rid the place of vermin. So they're actually working animals, and their place on a farm I don't think can be disputed. I would like to address a couple of issues. One was the conditional use permit. One of the individuals that was here and was able to testify last time told the story that she had gone to the county to try and get a conditional use prior to purchasing property, and it was going to cost her upwards of $5,000. It would take maybe 6 months, and there was no guarantee after she paid the $5,000 that she would even be able to get a conditional use. So I think that really does make a difference. I think that just makes the whole process more difficult. Another thing I like to address is that this isn't just for dog agility. There's lure coursing, tracking. Search and rescue, I did not realize, is specialized. There is wilderness search and rescue, and they do have to practice on farmland. There's just no other way to do it. And I don't think anyone can dispute the service that these dogs provide. As far as classes are concerned, usually there's a limit of 8 to 10. Excuse me, I'm so nervous my mouth is dry. Anyway, the classes are usually 8 to 10. They aren't big classes. So you're not talking about big lights, lots of noise. It just isn't happening. So the other issue is that because of the downturn in the economy, thank you very much. It's awful. I can't talk.
No reason to be nervous, but we are full service here. Any of you would like a latte, Mr. Stenbridge?
I used to make my living speaking, so I'm really nervous, and I appreciate your understanding. Horses used to use a lot of the, they were a big activity for your fairgrounds. And since the economy is, the downturn in the economy, people can't afford to show horses anymore, and they have dropped dates at the fairgrounds. A lot of the agility clubs have been able to pick those up. And my club alone, which is only one of many, put out $20,000 last year in rental of the fairgrounds. Now, if we weren't going to pick that up, that would be lost income to the fairgrounds. Linn County alone had an income last year from dog events of $107,000. And the Travel Bureau estimates that the total impact to businesses, including restaurants and hotels and supplies and a whole plethora of things, is about $2.5 million. And that's just to Linn County alone. So,
if you could wrap up your testimony, we'd
I will.
Have more testimony.
Okay. I was just going to say that if you weren't going to allow people to train, they wouldn't be competing. And that income that now goes to the fairgrounds would not be there. And it would leave a deficit in the to the fairgrounds of over $100,000, which would definitely impact the services they provide and would mean a loss of jobs. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? We appreciate y'all being here. Thanks so much. And our last panel on this topic is Noreen, Sean, and Jim. Don't let them scare you off, Noreen.
Thank you.
I'm going to put
that. Welcome to the Rules Committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Noreen Cartwright. I live in Lake Oswego, Oregon. I went to my first dog show in 1962. I was a breeder, exhibitor, trainer, and now judge. It's been interesting to listen to the testimony, and I want to go back to the to the primary purpose of the introduction of this bill. We are asking for statewide regulations that will apply statewide. As soon as you go to a land use permit, you are avoiding that part of what we want to do. We will put it back into the interpretations county by county, which, as you have already heard, is not always the best situation for the people personally involved. In addition, there was comment made about impact of events on farm property with lights and with noise. However, if you look at the lines that refer to horses, horses also can have training clinics and schooling shows. There isn't a dog as big as a horse requiring horse trailering, requiring horse space out there, unless you compare the Great Dane to the miniature horses. So for me, that's a red herring, to worry about lights and parking and noise on neighbors when you're talking about farms that are acres big. You're going to have to be firing a shotgun to annoy the neighbors, because they're not going to hear the yelling and the screaming. They're not going, if there is yelling and screaming, because some of these events are silent. Specific mention was made about agility and about kennels. The phrase in this bill says kenneling. Kenneling is a housing thing. It is not kennels that usually bring up connotations of breeding kennels, puppy mills, mass production, sneaky sales. We're talking about kenneling as in housing. The speakers also did not refer to showing or training dogs for racing. What they stated was that this did not involve events as written. However, as soon as you say showing, that is an event. They also focus solely on agility. Agility is a hotshot sport right now. It's bringing in most people. It is a great public relations for purebred dogs. But in addition to agility, as has been mentioned, there's all kinds of other things that are happening. Obedience training, which is basic good manners for those 440,000 households with dogs and hopefully kids. The socialization involved for those pets to be good mannered. All of that happens in training facilities, and all of that involves families and kids. Lure coursing, herding, field trialing, all of those events need training, handlers and dogs. The best place to do that is close to your town. You don't want to have to drive 3 hours to federal land. And the best place to do that is on large acreage. There was statements made about the implication to the dogs if those kinds of lands were, if the farmlands, the EFU lands, were taken out of the possibility. You realize, of course, that search and rescue dogs have got to train in rural areas, creeks and trees and mountains and stubble, because that's where people get lost. The police dogs...
If we can get you to wrap up your testimony, we've still got...
Two more things.
More. Okay, great.
Police dogs cannot be trained only in cities because police dogs follow the crooks out into the farmland. Various kinds of service dogs, they have to serve in all kinds of terrain, all kinds of places. So there's the basic specific thing is uniform statewide and recognize that there's a whole lot more to the background of what we're asking for training facilities. And I thank you very much.
Thank you. Gentlemen, the briefer the better. No pressure, though.
Sure. Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Farm Bureau of Oregon. We represent over 7,000 family farms in Oregon. And I'd like to just touch on a few aspects regarding the particular legislation. Number one, I think from the conversation, it's clear that everybody supports the Dash 2 amendments, which would remove this type of activity from a farm use assessment. That would be a consideration that Farm Bureau would advocate for. And number two, the Farm Bureau would also advocate that this bill or this activity be made part of the conditional use process. That's specifically ORS 215-213 sub K, which would be kenneling for marginal lands, 215-283 sub N for non-marginal lands. Now, the reason we would advocate this way is because in our land use statutes for EFU, we have two sections, sub 1's uses and sub 2 uses. The sub 2 uses are those situations where counties may apply additional criteria for the siting. Now, there was a lot of comments made today about horses being a particular use that would be somewhat consistent or draw a corollary between horse agility courses and farm dog agility courses, and I can totally understand that. Now, the one situation that comes to my mind is... a little story from my childhood. When I was 7, my parents bought me a beautiful black lab. I think he outweighed me in the 7th grade by probably 20 pounds. And when I was enrolled into obedience training by my mother, he took me on the obedience training. It was very hard to control. Now, when one of these facilities may abut livestock, there could be a situation where there would be a conflict. So just a simple cursory thought exercise, I can come up with at least one reason why this committee may want to consider incorporating an amendment to make this type of activity a sub 2 use, because it would have the potential. Because dogs do have a mind of their own. Trust me, I'm a huge lover of dogs, but they do occasionally require obedience training and sometimes get away from a leash. So under that theory is why the Farm Bureau would advocate for that sub 2 use.
And I just want to touch on one last thing, Senate Bill 960, which is a bill the Farm Bureau has worked with the counties and Oregon Wine Growers Associations and a variety of other interest groups, Thousand Friends included, to provide a relief valve for the Legislative Assembly when we do have issues on the county level that the county interprets the statute to say that anything not expressly prohibited or allowed in statute is prohibited. 960 would allow limited activities, two over-the-counter non-land use decision activities with a limited amount of activities a year, and one conditional activity that would allow up to 18 activities a year. We feel that this legislation is a step in the right direction to allow some flexibility for a variety of events, whether they be dog use agility or model plane or model train shows, what have you. So with that, I will wrap up my testimony and open up to any questions that the committee might have.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Jim, welcome.
Chair Hunt and Chair Olson, Jim Welsh representing Oregon Cattlemen Association. Just want to let you know that I represent over 2,000 members with thousands and thousands of acres. And we are an association that default to supporting those landowners and their property rights. And so many times we have, since 1972, as we all know, continued to regulate everything on our land. In this environment, and especially this session, when we, so many of us, have talked about jobs and economic development, we see something like this certainly being in conflict if we don't provide a location where we can do some of these things with our dogs, training and events. We'd also know that all of us as cattlemen enjoy our dogs, but we use them in livestock and herding. And a lot of our members are multiple livestock owners. They also have sheep and cattle, and so there's a lot of working dogs. They also like to hunt, and so they have to have locations and expect people to have locations to train their dogs for hunting. This is something that we have talked many hours about, and we are an association that would say, folks, where would they be allowed to do these things if they weren't on large acreages in farm and forest lands? So we support this bill. We support the opportunity for dog trainers and for those who want to have events. The conflicts we think will be minimum, and we want to be very supportive and remind you that this is and can be, if we continue to work very hard in possibly reducing regulation and requirements on our lands and allowing property rights of our owners to really be the priority. And we think this can be helpful for Oregon in the future. And so we support the bill and the efforts of those, especially NAIA, because we've worked with them and promised them so many times that we would work together, and they support us in our efforts also. And so here we are. Okay. We may be in conflict with some other large landowners in some respects, but not very many. We just want this to be an opportunity. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Holby, briefly.
Thank you. Just a quick question for Sean. Earlier there was mention of the conditional use permit system denying these types of activities because the land was deemed high value. And I'm not exactly aware of that restriction on conditional use permits, but does that happen?
Chair Olson, Chair Hunt, Representative Holby, from my understanding, the LCDC rule that implements the kennel provision of the EFU land use provisions does add an additional requirement that those kennels not be placed on high-value farmland. I believe that we could work with LCDC to modify their rules, and I think that a statute that would provide expressly that kennels and agility courses under the conditional use process would require them to modify their rulemaking, especially if this assembly and this committee were to expressly say that there would be no limitations over the type of land that would qualify for siting. Now, I will also add that we would advocate that anybody with high-value farm land would be a producer and actively producing on that property because it is a scarce resource even in Oregon. However, I would also recognize that the Willamette Valley is a place where we, our population center is, and finding opportunities for these types of agility courses on lower-value farms in the valley may be somewhat limiting.
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. Just very quick. That concerns me that LCDC has taken that rule because as I read the allowed uses on EFU lands, those are allowed uses that can be approved by the county, and there is no mention or prohibition about whether it's high-use agricultural land. Those rules, I think, are contrary to our statutes. So,
well, let me suggest we follow up this conversation offline. We're not scheduled for a work session today, so we appreciate all three of your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. And I would close the public hearing on House Bill 3653 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3086. Again, this is relating to the Early Learning Council. I invite forward Representative Wisnett. And why don't we also bring up Janet Carlson and Randy Frankie at this point, and we've got two more folks after them. Representative Wisnett, welcome to the Rules Committee.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Olson and Hunt and honorable committee members. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, House District 53. Thank you for allowing me to testify, and I'll be brief. Chairs and committee members, I strongly urge a no vote on moving this bill to the Ways and Means or passing the bill. If it has to go to Ways and Means for further study, I understand. I do support the concept of Senate Bill 909A and will continue studying that bill. Committee members, beside this lady next to me, I have a lot of experience and knowledge of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families and the local Children and Families Commissions. I've served on the Deschutes County Commission as the Vice Chair and Chair, and I served on the State Commission for Children and Families. I've attended two national meetings on state children's cabinets and a Harvard Early Childhood Conference. I believe the state and the local commission system has been successful in accomplishing its mission and has positively impacted our children, youth, and families. Committee members and chairs, I would ask you to look at the Senate Bill 909. The Early Learning Council is required by that proposed bill to submit by December 2011 its plans to merge, redesign, or improve coordination of early childhood services. It further states the plan will address certain programs and services funded or administered by the State Commission on Children and Families. House Bill 3086 is premature. How can we eliminate the State Commission until the Early Learning Center submits recommendations to the 2012 session? I believe House Bill 3086 will create chaos for the counties and the existing system. Please let the early, let me back up that everyone at the panel here, I think we spent last year 3 or 4 days, and probably Commissioner Carlson probably spent weeks. We were asked by a legislator to look at the commission system and come up with suggestions and recommendations. I would hate to summarize how many hours and time was spent in doing that study, coming up with a plan and recommendations that nothing was done with that. So I hope that would be an early start for the early learning design team. Committee members and chairs, please let this team do their work in accordance with Senate Bill 909 to ensure the greatest success for providing services for our children and families. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Janet?
I'm good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Randy, welcome.
Thank you. Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, honorable members of the Rules Committee. My name is Randy Franke. I'm the current chair of the Marion County Children and Families Commission, past commissioner for Marion County for 24 years, past president of the National Association of Counties, and have a master's degree in corrections from Western Oregon. I mention all of that because my interest in adult corrections, juvenile corrections, and early childhood is longstanding. Ever since I was first elected as a Marion County Commissioner, those three areas were areas of my concentration and concern. As president of the National Association of Counties, I've introduced and brought to that organization the issues of early childhood. Because the things, as we look at how children start, whether it's a good start or a not so good start, affects a whole host of programs that counties are involved in. Juvenile corrections, adult corrections, mental health issues, teen pregnancy, you name a host of issues that counties deal with. These things, how a child starts, impacts those things as well as their success in school. So it was my honor to attend the presentation of the Starting Points, which is a Carnegie Foundation study back in 1994, actually after House Bill 2004 was passed by this legislature. And I want to mention that because the findings in that study, I think, are still relevant today and where we're going today in terms of early childhood. And if you look at the study, you'll see a host of members of the advisory committee from prestigious universities, Stanford, Harvard, Columbia, North Carolina, and a couple of other universities involving pediatricians, child psychologists, and other individuals working on early childhood issues. I support and thank Representative Kotek for giving us a vehicle to continue looking at how we can support the governor's initiative in early childhood. I don't think anybody disagrees with the importance of improving early childhood, improving children's readiness for school, because that'll have a positive impact on graduation rates and all those other programs I mentioned that county spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on every year. As we look at those issues, the issue isn't the goal. The issue is, as it always is, the devil's in the detail. How do we get from here to where the governor wants to go and I think everybody else wants to go? Our children can ill afford us to make a misstep in that process. They're not going to wait for us to correct it. Our concern is not what we're called. I've gone through three iterations, from the Juvenile Services Commission to the Community and Children Commission to the Children and Families Commission. The name means nothing. We don't care. We're not afraid of reorganizing and refocusing our efforts on what we've learned from the past. In fact, we have time and time again, and we're ready to do so again. Our concern is looking at the proposal, looking at the goal, looking at the budget for those goals is a concern of money, first of all. Is the program going to be adequately funded? And two, losing some existing resources that are already in the communities that, if used, could speed up the implementation of the governor's early childhood initiatives. We have people in the communities that already are trained in the aspects, the functional aspects that the governor's early childhood is looking for in terms of contracting, outcome-based contracting, facilitation of services, wraparound services. Those are all in existence. We don't think our children can afford to lose those resources when we don't know how much time it's going to take for a new system to be developed and implemented. They're there already. We encourage their use. I would just simply note, in terms of the starting points, the 4 points that it called for: promote responsible parenthood, guaranteed quality child care choices, ensure good health and protection, mobilize communities to support young children and families. The same principles, I think, hold true for the governor's early childhood. As we look around at the wraparound services that are going to be needed It's not just about government money and government services. Again, the Carnegie Foundation talks about this. It's about mobilizing those other aspects in the community, whether it's the faith community, the business community, or existing nonprofit providers in the community, all to support those needs in identified families and children. And thank you for your consideration. Thank you for allowing us to testify. And again, we're in support of the bill before you in terms of the Dash 2 amendments. And failing the Dash 2 amendments, Dash 1 with some amendments to that, if not the full Dash 2s. Thank you.
Thank you. And Jenna, before you go, there is supposed to be another committee hearing in here at 5. They're going to shift it.
They're moving.
Okay. Yeah. So any of you who are here for that hearing, they're shifting to hearing room
D. They're right next door.
Janet, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee. I'm Janet Carlson, Commissioner for Marion County. I'm serving as the Association of Oregon Counties President this year. Earlier this year, the Association of Oregon Counties convened a task force on the Commission on Children and Families, the AOC convened a task force on the Commission on Children and Families issues. You have a copy of the report in front of you that came out in March of 2011. On page 4, we made recommendations around the Governor's Early Learning Plan. And you will see on page 4 that AOC supports generally the vision of the governor for early childhood development and school preparedness, creating a statewide body with oversight functions for early learning, helping the governor promote changes to early childhood services, results-based outcomes, and building on existing programs, infrastructure, and partnerships. And then you'll see a whole list of areas of concern that we also identified. And if I could just narrow down what those areas of concern are, they're really on taking that local talent pool we have at the local level, the partnerships, the relationships of it all, that have already been built, and being able to apply those to the problem of integrating and better coordinating early childhood services. So we do, as Representative Wisnett talked about, support the local commission system. The issue is, in this time of very tight budgets, are we going to be able to fund both systems to the extent where the commission system will continue to be viable? And that's been our big concern. So we've been thinking creatively about how we might integrate the commission system with the governor's goals for early learning, and hence that's why we support House Bill 3086-1, and we'd really do appreciate Representative Kotek's work to help bring about really the answers to many of the elements that we support and her willingness to work with us on the other elements. You'll also see in front of you a memo from Marion County that basically says we're ready to go whenever you are. So our commission system in Marion County is very robust. We have a lot of great partners at the table. We get a lot done. We've been working on early childhood and early learning, and we believe we could move forward. Our concerns with the Dash 1 amendments, and hence why we worked with Representative Clem to develop the Dash 2s, is that we don't see the playing field as being entirely level in the Dash 1 amendments. The sunset of all of the local commission statutes starting July 1, 2012, without replacement language, means that if the report from the local commissions that's anticipated, I think it's in Section 59, comes forward to the Early Learning Council, and the Early Learning Council says, well, thank you, but, you know, we've got a different idea. We're going to run this out of a state agency or whatever. Number one, we don't have any ability to take that report to the legislature, so that part is in the Dash 2 amendments. And number two, we would, if nothing happens in the February session, and I've been in this building as a member, and I know none of you can guarantee that in a short session things will work out. You would like them to work out, but you can't guarantee they will. By a vote this session on sunsetting those bills, nothing happening in February means there's no replacement language, and the county system would literally just be abolished. It would be gone. So what we want, in the Dash 2s, we made an attempt to have some language that something would take over on July 1, 2012. That's the part that's not exactly right. Representative Kotek talked about there's some elements of it that didn't come out of legislative council exactly the way we anticipated it. We were actually putting some permissive language in to allow county commissioners to appoint local early learning councils, and then those would move forward the second half of that biennium. So there'd be some bridge language. It may be premature to have that bridge language, but anyway, that's in essence what's different about the Dash 2s than in the Dash 1s, and we also want to express our appreciation to Representative Clem for working with us on the Dash 2s.
I understand that given the short, the June 30th deadline that you have, that things are different than they were when I was here. And so I've been assured that policy amendments will be entertained in Ways and Means. I just want to make sure that I get on the record that if you do move this to Ways and Means, that we will have the opportunity to make those policy amendments there around the sunset, around the legislative report, and if there is a sunset, putting some bridge language in. A third piece that AOC voted on today, which they actually voted to support the two parts that I've talked about, is to make sure that the system is denoted as voluntary in the statutes. If you look in 3086-1, I don't know that you see the word voluntary there. It's there in 2001 when we did the early childhood bill. It was there, I can't remember, 36, 40 times. It's there in places where it makes no sense to be, but it's all over the place there. When those statutes actually are removed, then all of that goes away as well. So there was one of our members and the whole group endorsed making sure that that's noted in the statutes. And I think I have covered everything that I was going to cover. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify and your willingness to work with us as we try to move down this path.
Great. Thank you all. Questions for this panel? We appreciate you being here. Thanks. Our last two witnesses on this, Bill Thomas and Killian Wessenberg.
I'm with him.
Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you. Co-Chair Hunt and Co-Chair Olson and members of the committee, my name is Bill Thomas. I am the Director of the Washington County Commission on Children and Families, and I'm here today to testify on their behalf. Doug Riggs, who you know in wearing other hats, is one of the co-chairs of our local Commission on Children and Families. The other co-chair is Marilyn Harrison, who is the Director of Child Development Programs for Nike, Incorporated. Our commission fully supports the governor's vision and goals for restructuring early childhood services, and we appreciate the efforts of Representative Kotek for proposing amendments to House Bill 3086 in order to provide implementing legislation for this restructuring. We support the four objectives or purposes that Representative Kotek outlined in her testimony, and I will not go through them again. We do think we have two concerns that have been touched on in the prior testimony by Randy Frankie and Janet Carlson. We think that in the February session, the legislature should review the recommendations that are developed by local commissions, as well as the recommendations that are developed by the Early Learning Council. It is for that reason that we had asked that either the Rules Committee today, or if this goes to Ways and Means, at the Ways and Means Committee, add a provision to Section 59 that would specify the report that is and recommendations that's developed by local commissions by September 15th be submitted to the relevant interim legislative committees as well as to the Early Learning Council. As Commissioner Carlson indicated, it's a way to have a little bit more of a level playing field. We think that these decisions are very important to the whole state, and the legislature needs to be in a position to make those decisions by having both sets of recommendations. Lastly, we think that it is premature to sunset the statutes and references related to local commissions prior to a review of the recommendations from both local commissions and the Early Learning Council and the February session. That may be one course. It may be the course to amend the existing statutes. So we have are asking that the committee, or again, that Ways and Means would consider deleting the sections of the -1 amendments that would repeal the statutes on related to children and families and remove those references in the statutes, and that would have the benefit of eliminating 50 pages from the bill of conforming language. As Representative Freeman mentioned, it's a very large bill. Our commission did endorse the -2 amendments developed by Representative Clem, but most, if not all, of our concerns would be addressed by those two actions. One, ensuring that the report from the local commissions would be submitted to the legislature as well as the Early Learning Council, and two, deleting the those sections of the Dash 1 amendments, which are from Section 60 to, through Section 92, that would repeal the local commission statutes. We truly believe that the best way to achieve the goals of both the governor and the legislature is to preserve the effective community-based infrastructure that's already in place. We think that will help accomplish the goals of and objectives of the Early Learning Council for Children 0 to 5, and also ensure that supports are provided for school-aged children and their families, those children from 6 to 19. We don't want to lose those, as our chair said at the Budget Committee, or the Ways and Means Committee hearing on the State Commission budget, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. This approach of building on what we have would build on 30 years of experience since that first Juvenile Services Commission that Randy Franken mentioned that was established in 1979. We've been implementing, local commissions have been implementing evidence-based practice in one form or another, under one name or another, for those 30 years. We do have, as Janet Carlson indicated, a strong local professional talent pool and hundreds of volunteers. We are fully prepared to adapt and to evolve, as Representative Freeman suggested, and to change. Some of us have had conversations with Representative Kotek and have assured her that the message has been heard loud and clear. We are ready to change and be part of the solution. We pledge to work closely with all parties to ensure that the state moves in a direction that can strengthen, that can ensure accountability, and that can align local structures to implement the goals of both the governor and the legislature. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Say anything or not. Okay.
Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Co-chairs Hunt and Olson and members of the committee, my name is Jillian Wiesenberg, and I am testifying on House Bill 3086 as a director of and on behalf of the Douglas County Commission on Children and Families. The Douglas County Commission on Children and Families supports improving outcomes for young children to enter school ready to learn. The commission has been actively working for 14 years with the more than 30 partners of the Douglas County Planning Coordinator. Anyway, it's a mouthful. Douglas County Early Childhood Planning Coalition, which we call the DCECPC, which is also a mouthful, to identify evidence-based practices for young children 0 to 8 in our county. The commission provides the coalition with leadership, technical assistance, and staff support to promote best practices in such areas as parenting, mental health 0 to 8, and literacy. The coalition membership includes representatives from schools, health providers, mental health providers, and early childhood agencies, as well as faith-based businesses, et cetera, et cetera. Since 2005, the coalition has raised more than $642,000 for parenting classes in Douglas County through grants and a parenting brokerage. And the parenting brokerage piece is the longevity, because we have partners who pay yearly to keep this going. Umpqua Community College is now the central point to register for the countywide classes, which shows how, you know, our collaboration works, that each partner pitches in a part, and there's not necessarily always money paid for those pieces. It's partnership. Recently, we have identified that a large number of class participants are being referred by local child welfare and parole and probation. That really concerns us, because there's a strong need. So what we're doing at the present time is talking to all our partners and identifying what all those needs are and what we can do to meet those needs. The Douglas County Commission on Children and Families appreciates Representative Kotek's efforts to align community engagement and the governor's early learning goals. In Douglas County, we have the established relationships to work together to achieve those goals. And what we are asking for is a place at the table in shaping the critical decisions for our youngest citizens. We're also asking that the local plan be reported to the legislature, because we feel that you have been strong partners with us, and we appreciate that, and we want to continue to be partners. And we also are here to ask, as far as sunsetting statutes as of July 1st, 2012, that you continue statutes for whether it's the local commission or whatever it's called for that local community engagement piece. We want to thank Representative Freeman and Representative Kotek for what they said today, that they acknowledge our concerns, and it's really nice to have that acknowledgement and that understanding. I'd also like to thank Representative Freeman for his ongoing concern about the children in our community and the ongoing communication. So thank you very much, and if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay. Doug, anything else to add?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Riggs. I'm the co-chair of the Washington County Commission on Children and Families. I don't have any prepared testimony. I would just simply say two things. I've been involved in government programs for 27 years. This is a system that is wonderfully effective in the local community because it engages people in the local community. It leverages local involvement, volunteerism. It leverages private grants. So it takes a small amount of seed money, which has been cut by 60% in the last 5 years, from $79 million down to $32 million, and it ensures great outcomes at the local level. So whatever the end of this process is, I hope it maintains and builds upon the very successful existing local infrastructure that we have. And I think this is a path that Bill's outlined, which hopefully will get us there. But I'd be terribly disappointed if we get to the end of this program and we have no local infrastructure that over the last 10 years has provided fantastic outcomes for kids.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you all. We appreciate you being here. Thanks for your testimony. So we are going to, in light of the testimony we received, we're going to carry the work session on this over until our Wednesday hearing of this week. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3086, and we'll pick that up in work session on Wednesday. And I believe we are adjourned.